Hi, and welcome to the Now Spinning podcast with me, Phil Aston. And in this week's episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me songwriter and vocalist Sam Brown. Now, you may know Sam from her late 80s million-selling hits like Stop or seven solo albums. However, I know many of my listeners and subscribers will know some of her work from working with Gary Moore, George Harrison, John Lord, Pink Floyd, obviously, and David Gilmour. And Sam has just released her latest album called Number 8. But the journey to this album has been very much a unique one. It's a story about courage, determination, acceptance, and a lot of creative thinking, I would imagine. Because in 2007, Sam, your voice as you knew it took flight and disappeared. You were very busy at that time. You just released a new album. You were on tour with your dad. And you also, I think, in the top 10 with an album with Jules Holland. You were very, very busy. I think moving house and lots of stuff going on. So when this happened, did you think it was just like a temporary thing when your voice went?
I wasn't really sure, Phil. I really had no idea. It was very upsetting when it first happened. So all I wanted to do was to get it fixed and to try and find a way through it. And I just haven't, which is, you know, is that's how it is. And as you say, acceptance is harmony. Well, it is when you've got an auto-tune program anyway. Yeah, I didn't really think about whether it would last. I think I kind of thought that I maybe needed to give myself some time because, as you say, it was a really busy time. And I was just splitting up with my husband as well, so and moving down south from Scotland. So it was a busy time. And so in some ways, I kind of thought it made sense that my voice would just say, no, I'm not doing this anymore, because I was the one thing that I did continue to do was work, because I love working and I absolutely adored singing in all of its forms with everyone that I sang with. So for me, it was a massive release when things were difficult. So when I just started to not be able to sing in tune and pitch notes, it was horrible, but I don't think I thought it would last forever. I thought it might be, you know, a question of just taking some time out and having the right advice and seeing the right doctors. But I've seen a lot of doctors now and I've taken a lot of advice and it still hasn't come back.
So you did try lots of things to find a solution.
Yeah, I really did. I tried, I saw, I think, three of the top specialists in this country. I went over to California to see someone over there who was lovely. But all of the laryngologists basically said there isn't anything wrong. With your voice, you know, with your vocal cords, because what they do is they look at your vocal cords and they can look at how the muscles are working.
Yeah.
I thought it was muscular. In retrospect, I think it's probably probably psychological and emotional, and I just still haven't found a way to unblock that. Whether I ever will, I don't know. But, you know, there are other things to life and you have to move forwards. You can't get stuck in a place. So I love teaching uke, but I am so absolutely chuffed to have made this record. It's been a total revelation, and I know it sounds a bit cheesy, but I've rediscovered my creative self, which has just been wonderful.
Because during this period, as a build-up to this, obviously when you lost your voice, did you say it must have been such a difficult thing to get yourself around mentally as well as physically, that all of your creativity of writing music and thinking creatively, also kind of your creative muse kind of fell off its horse as well, didn't it? Quite naturally.
I just didn't want to write anything. I didn't want to play anything. I didn't want to, because whenever I played an instrument, I mean, my first instrument's piano. If I sat down at the piano, I would start writing a song. I'd just start singing and it would come very naturally. So obviously I couldn't do that. So playing the piano without singing was, I just couldn't face it. And I couldn't really face writing. Over the last few years, I've definitely had a few bits and pieces of ideas and kind of been thinking, you know, I should really try and just do something with the voice I've got, which is very limited. But, you know, I can, as you said, you've listened to the album, you can hear that it's all very low, isn't it? You know, and I think the basic of it is very in a very low range. And so I had started sort of working with that. But when I started writing with Danny, we wrote a few songs. The first two were a bit rubbish. And then the songs were okay. But when I came to sing them, it was really upsetting because the problem with my voice is it's quite random. So some days it's better than others. But there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to that. And I've tried everything, diet, coffee, not drinking, exercise, whatever, you know. So it was quite difficult because it was like waiting for my voice to be in a good enough place to actually sing anything at all. So eventually what I did was I just was very pragmatic about it. And I just said, I'm just going to sing it through three times. Then I'm going to do what we call a comp. So get the best of that and see how it goes. But the thing that made it all work is when I put it into Melodyne and I put it into the auto-tune program and started. And then when I'd auto-tuned it properly, it all came to life. It really did. It was like, oh, actually, this could work. This is not too bad.
Is that when you started to see a way forward? You started to think, yeah, I couldn't actually start to create music again?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And have you started playing the piano again and creating music from that perspective?
Well, I haven't because I haven't got a piano. So I'm sort of a bit all over the place because this probably is a bit boring for everyone, but after sort of a few years, well, in 2015, because I had two kids and I was on my own with my two kids, when I was singing, I was able to afford quite a big mortgage. So we had a big house, but of course my income took a real nosedive and I got into a bit of debt. It wasn't terrible in retrospect, but it was giving me panic attacks in the night. And, you know, and so in the end, I just thought, no, I'm just going to sell everything. And the kids were sort of 19, 20. So they were ready to sort of move on.
Yeah.
And we moved to Dorset, which is where I now live. But there was no room for a piano. And so my piano went back up to my old house in Scotland, where my ex-husband has a studio and a lovely room for it. And the kids are there, so they play it. So I haven't had a piano for ages. But next week, I shall be getting my mum's piano because I'm moving again.
Oh, brilliant.
And I've got a room for the piano. So that's really exciting.
So you can see yourself creating music on a piano again in the future, which is lovely. Yeah,
I hope so.
Fantastic. Okay, so with the new album, because one thing about, which is very obvious, the way that the album's been put together, and Sue, my wife, mentioned this when we listened to it traveling in the car the other week, is you can hear every word. And there aren't many albums where you can hear literally every word of every line of every chorus and every verse. And I think that is a very much a positive thing. And lyrically, all the songs seem connected and very observational. Are they personal observations of how you see modern life, or are some of them like an observation of your own journey to get to this album?
I think it's a mixture of both. Lyrics are really important to me. And whilst my brother didn't produce this album, he was involved in it. But working with Pete over the years, you know, he instigated, and I also feel very strongly that lyrics are really important. They're important to me. I'm a big fan of Sia, but I cannot understand a bloody word she's singing. It takes me years to get. The other day I was in the car listening to one of her tracks and I said, oh, I thought she's saying it's agony, but she was going, it's agony. And I was like, what's it? It's agony. I just couldn't work it out. So it's really important to me. I think the lyrics on this album are quite dark, but it's not specifically about my personal journey, but I think it's, if you wanted to have a broad sense of it, it's about, you know, having an insurmountable problem and finding a way around it, or finding a way through it, is probably more the thing to say. And I hope that that's a positive message for people, that, you know, it's just, I suppose it's thinking in a different way about how you do things. And that's what it's been for me. It's just been a kind of shift of how I look at things and what I want to say, you know. So the lyrics are really, they are coming from me, but they're not necessarily all about my own personal experience.
On the first track, It's Okay, I mean, that feels like it's about your journey back to where you are now. And it's also, it feels like it's about a story of acceptance and kindness towards the situation. Would that be?
Yeah. And I think also it's, you know, I mean, the first line, it's okay to be broken. It's okay to be blue. And I think, you know, it is okay. I mean, we, you know, in this day and age, everybody talks about their feelings and how difficult things are and all that sort of stuff. And yeah. I think really I was brought up to just put a blooming smile on your face and get on with it, which I have to say is a very useful tool. And I'm glad I've got that. But I think it's important also to accept that it is all right. It's all right. Life isn't, it's not a fairy tale, is it? You know, we've all been brought up with fairy tales, and life is definitely not like that. We all have difficulties, and that's okay, because they don't last forever.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful song. As you say, the lyrics are dark, but they're also very, as I say, positive. You know, and I think a lot of people will see themselves in those lines. The next one, of course, I'm sure, but what at some point will be a massive viral hit on TikTok or something, which is Doll. And where you're saying just about, you know, being able to put a mask on when you're not feeling absolutely 100%. This one feels like it's about Instagram and profile photos that have been filtered to death. Was this an observational look at the world of social media?
I think it is. It's also coming from the point of view of a mature woman, if you like, which is, you know, because it says, why do I want to look like a doll? Why do you want to look like a doll? Why does anyone want to look like a doll? And why do you want me to look like a doll? And so I think it's about expectations of how we look. I love makeup. I love dressing up. I really enjoy it. This isn't a judgmental song. I'm not judging anyone, because I think in a lot of ways, social media is very positive for young people, because it gives them the opportunity to present themselves to their friends and to the world in the way that they want to be seen.
Yes.
And so I think that's quite a positive thing. Having said that, I also have to, you know, say the thing that is going to make me sound like an old fuddy-duddy, which is, you don't need to put stuff into your face to make it a different shape, and you don't need to always be pouting. And, you know, I mean, I'm getting jowls as I get older, you know, and that's just natural for someone of my age. So I think it's sort of saying, yes, have a positive image of yourself, but also don't worry if you don't look like a doll. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, yeah. The next one, Injured, feels like the way that the album is sequenced, it does seem like to tell a story. This one seems to dip back to It's Okay. And again, is this one's a little bit autobiographical about how your life as well? Is it this one? It's how it felt to me. About the singer who's lost her voice rather than the person behind the voice.
Yeah, I think it's, yes. I remember I had an operation on my voice in the early days of losing it. And I went out, had to go out to the shops, but I couldn't speak. So I had to hold cards up to people and sort of point. And yeah. I had a really interesting experience, because so many people were like, oh no, you poor I mean, people, you know, shop assistants were actually cuddling me. And it was like, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. I just can't talk to you, you know. And I think it's that sort of some people's reaction if they know someone else has got a problem, is pity, is, you know, oh, you poor thing. But actually, if you're a person who has a real problem, for instance, if you have a disability, or my daughter has very, very, very severe eczema all over her body.
Yeah.
And of course, it's very visible. And people react in a pitying way. And it's not really always useful to have that attitude. It's nice that people care. But sometimes you need someone to say, should we go and sit in the corner where it's dark so that no one can see you? You know, it's like it's practical solutions, real solutions for people who have very real problems. And I think Injured, it doesn't come across in that way, but that was sort of what was in my mind, was A lot of people who have physical problems or any problems, they don't want pity. They want support and understanding.
Yeah, I guess you're right, because otherwise they're like constantly reminded that there's something wrong. You may have got up in the morning and you put whatever issue it is behind you. You've accepted it. You're going out into the world, and the first thing you do is bump into someone who goes, "Oh dear, that must be awful."
It's just a viewpoint, really, isn't it? But for me, I think, you know, a lot of people feel the loss of my voice, and I feel the loss of my voice. But life goes on, and there are people with much bigger problems than that.
The next one is another day. And this, again, this feels, they all feel connected. And this kind of felt to me that you were saying that life can just slip by with the mundane busyness of stuff, that just kind of just digital noise that's all around us, all our to-do lists, and whether they're real or imagined or whatever. And if we don't pay attention, everything just disappears.
It's very much that. It's the sort of noise of the modern world, you know. And it makes me sort of think of, I was lucky enough to know George Harrison. And one of the things that he sort of used to say or kind of, you know, intimate was that, you know, none of us are really that important. We're all just specks of dust. And I think, you know, if you kind of take a long view of the earth with all these little kind of creatures running around on it, doing whatever, you know, it's every day is just another day, isn't it? And it's about that. Yeah, spot on, Phil.
Thank you. And Marionette, this is like a breakup song or someone wanting to get rid of their mobile.
I think actually Marionette is probably, it's not my least favourite, because I love the groove. I love the groove on the chorus.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I don't really know what it is about. I think it's, hang on, how does it go? Let me think about it.
It's got that lovely little jazz interlude as well.
Yeah, that's Danny. I had to give Danny a moment. So I did the album with Danny, I've known him for a long time, and he's basically a really brilliant pianist. Mm. I've written with him since I was about 15. And Marionette, you've got to get on with it. You've got to get out, get on with it. I think it's just sort of, don't let other people pull your strings and get out there and do what you think is right. Is really the idea, I think.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, not for anyone. I felt this was quite a sad song, about someone who's almost, it felt like they'd built a wall around their heart to not only protect themselves, but to also stop anyone else getting in ever again. It's a very deep song, and the chorus about saying, you know, what, you're trying to get close, but I don't want to hurt anyone ever again, but I'm not going to let you get any further closer to me as well. I imagine this will resonate with lots of people as they go through the journey of life.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's about, as I've got older, I think I see that in any relationship, there has to be a commitment, you know, there has to be a commitment to each other. Yeah. And it is specifically about committing yourself to somebody in a loving relationship. Because I don't know about everyone else, but I'm sure lots of people are tempted, but it causes a lot of pain, I think, you know, when there's infidelity, and it's something that I've experienced. And I think, you know, I could, as I've got older, I've realized how far that pain goes, you know, just for your own kind of, you know, if you really don't want to be with someone, then you have to not be with them. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. But actually, you know, even flirting with other people, I think it's quite hurtful. And I know if I was out with my boyfriend and he did it, I would be upset and hurt, and I'm sure he would be as well. And it's quite a small thing, but, you know, especially for younger people, I think love figures greatly in their lives, doesn't it? You know,
it's
important to them. Well, it is the most important thing when you're younger, isn't it?
Yes.
And then, I mean, I don't know about you, but obviously love is important to me now, but it becomes different as you get older. It becomes more, much more practical and day to day. You want to be able to spend, you know, happy time with your partner, don't you, all the time? It's not just this kind of big love thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's about that. It's about, I suppose I'm saying I would never want to hurt anyone again. So I would never even consider, you know, being unfaithful. It's just about that.
Okay. Shift is the next one. And this one, again, this reminded me of the one about the busyness of life, because it's about, it felt like it was about the way that life, as where we are alive now at our point in time on planet Earth, is changing so much, so quickly.
Yeah, no, that's, you're absolutely right. I think with the digital, you know, the onset of the digital world, if you like, it is a massive shift. And I think we've moved so much, so quickly, and in so many ways over the last, say, 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, life is so different, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about that. But I think there will be, I think there's another shift coming, which is going towards creativity. And I'm not a big hippie, by the way. I'm quite a skeptical sort of person. But I see my kids and the people they know and other young people, they look at life differently. And I think they're starting to understand that, you know, phones and scrolling and not actually having an album or a CD, it's like real things don't exist anymore, do they? You know, it's like music. If you want to get music, you have to get vinyl, or, you know, go out of your way to find a CD. I mean, there's lots of people I like, and I can't actually get hold of any of their music. I can't actually buy it, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think we've got everything accessible at our fingertips. We can suddenly be watching the TV and think, who's that person been in? And we'll quickly Google and find out everything and go down a rabbit hole, and we can get anything. But I think the same as my youngest son, he'll stream music, but he'll buy the vinyl album, and he'll send off for the signed version, because he wants to connect and almost feel as close as possible to the creative process of the person who created the art. Yeah. And the same way as books didn't disappear when the Kindle arrived, you know, people love the tactile sense, and websites like Etsy, where you can send off for a birthday card that's been designed by someone that's only available from that individual. I think I agree with you. I think we're aware of how fast the wheels are turning, but we almost want to go back to everything being handmade and crafted by an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And as you say, the idea that all of us are creative.
Yeah, everyone's creative. Absolutely. There's so much of it around now. It's wonderful. You know, I think it's great. People, I mean, that's my experience. Maybe that's just my world. I don't know. But, you know.
No. So I think that with the music business, the people that buy CDs or vinyl may be niche compared with the overall big part of the cake that's all about streaming. But I think it's a very important niche, because it is the people that want to be as close as possible to the person who's creating the music themselves.
Absolutely, yeah, that's
and
right.
And I actually think that will grow and become more.
I think it will too. I think it will. I think young people will start to crave it and, you know, want that, you know.
Yes, very much so. The next song is called Showgirl, which is a very observational song and another excellent song lyrically. What was the inspiration for this one?
Well, I think this is probably, funnily enough, the most personal song. I think it's, from my point of view, very angry and very dark. I was very depressed when I wrote the lyric, and it's about being, you know, having to be who people want you to be, which, of course, you know, in my younger years when I was promoting and doing television and all that sort of thing, is very much a large part of what you do. I mean, as it happens, I just like meeting people. So it wasn't like I didn't have to put a face on, as it were. But I think it's about, you know, there's a person underneath it. And I think it's quite a common idea that people think you should be like your, you know, you're the person that is famous, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So, you know, people think you that you owe them something because you're famous. Not, I mean, I haven't particularly experienced that myself, but I've seen it a lot where people will, I've been out with Jules or my dad, or, I mean, I was on stage with Jules once and he was playing the piano and a woman actually got up on the stage and asked for his autograph while he was playing.
God.
Yeah, and I it's just that sort of thing of not seeing that person as a human being, you know, and not always affording them the normal courtesy that you would anybody else. I mean, it's not just that, I suppose. It's also everybody has so many different sides to their personality, and I think everyone changes according to who they're with, you know.
Of course. I mean, you obviously grew up in a showbiz family, really, with, you know, your dad, Joe, and your mom, Vicky, that they, so you were coming up through that and they were already in that world, as you say, of being in the limelight. So did you kind of pick up on that? Did your parents have the same thing where they were expected to, you know, put on a certain face or
a certain way? I think, you know, that there's lots of different sides to it, Phil. You know, my dad gets it a lot, certainly did, you know, when I was growing up.
Yeah.
But equally, you know, when he goes out, he goes, "All right, mate, how's it going?" All right. So he sort of, that is also who he is.
That's also who he is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's just really the song is really just saying that just, you know, people who are well known, then there are other sides to them as well. That's all it is, I think, really.
Yeah. Does it, and then, because that kind of leads into the next one called Tribe. And it feels like it's its sister or brother. It seems related to her better than a showgirl who's lost and trying to find someone where you don't have to wear a mask to fit in. That's how I picked it up, anyway.
Yeah, no, that's, I like that. I like your sort of thread through the album. It's lovely. Well, I suppose absolutely you could do that. It was, I think, probably inspired by my kids and young people that I know where they don't feel like they fit in, especially kids at school. They don't always get to meet like-minded people until, for instance, they get to secondary school, or for most people, probably college, I'd say, where they start to go off into the world that they're going to be going into. But it can be quite isolating, I think, for kids sometimes when...
Yeah.
If they go to school in the countryside and their family aren't kind of like everybody else's family, that sort of thing. So it's about that. It's just saying that, you know, everyone's, that your people are out there somewhere. You just got to find the buggers.
Yeah. But actually, it isn't just the youngsters, because when I started Now Spinning Magazine, it was because I was aware that at my age that I was one of the few people in my peer group who was still buying music. Because everyone had either stopped, lost interest, or moved on through the busyness of life and stuff. And so I set it up thinking there must be someone else that still does this. And then I found lots of people around the world who also felt isolated, who didn't know anyone that still bought records or something. So I think there's even something in The Guardian about some bloke who set something up about people sitting in their sheds designing things. I think there's a need for us to feel as if we belong to something.
Yeah. Yeah.
A sense of belonging and to share ideas. So, yeah, I think I really, really love that song. Now, the next one does stand out as being different in this journey, which is Four on the Floor. This one is just straight aimed. It felt like it was aimed straight at the charts. Is it straight at the disco floor?
I sincerely hope so. Just a laugh. I love dancing. I love dance. And it's just saying, you know, it's just about dancing, really. Simple as that.
I thought ticked all those boxes. Yeah.
Had to be something completely meaningless on there, I suppose.
And then the last one. Lyrically, I like this one. I think probably the most, because it sounds like the start to me of a great TV drama full of mystery and angst, and that's how it kind of builds. It's got the music's lovely, but the lyrics are kind of like you wonder what happens next. what was the inspiration behind this one?
Well, I suppose it came musically. the inspiration for this one. My brother suggested that I get a keyboard with a vocoder on it. So sing into the microphone and play the notes. So that's how it sort of works. And I got it, and I got this sort of retro thing with all these really mad kind of sequencer stuff, very sort of 70s, 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And also at the time, it was sort of during lockdown. So watching, I don't know about, I mean, I'm not a big telly watcher normally, but we did watch a lot of, you know, all the television series, all the weird ones, and they've all got sort of 1980s electronica music and sequencing. Yeah. And I had this keyboard, and then I came out with that line, boom, 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 boom. So I took it to Danny, and he's like, oh yeah, yeah, you know, and it sort of was just inspired by the fantastic music that you get on box sets these days.
Yes,
and,
yes, that's right.
You know, all the episodes and everything, and I just love it. I love all the weird and wacky stuff you get, and then of course you need a story, I think, to go with that. And so we thought it sounded sort of French 60s kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So then there was the idea of the cafe, and then it was like, well, and then it was like he's dead or she's dead, and they're kind of visiting their partner, and they're wondering if she can feel them kissing her, you know, while.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's quite romantic, I think.
Ghost. It is, yes, it is. Well, yes, it is like a TV drama waiting to be written.
Yeah. Anyone feels like doing that, that's fine with me.
Exactly, yeah, the music exists already.
Yeah.
To me, again, because I said at the start, because I think the lyrics are so easy to hear and the way the album is sequenced, it's my favorite album next to 43 Minutes, which I know came out a long time ago. Yeah. And that was the one that you were writing just after your mom, Vicky, had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And
yeah.
So that was obviously a very dark time. And obviously it was the time you mentioned earlier about being accepted for who you are, et cetera. The record company were obviously determined for you to just do another upbeat pop album.
Yeah.
And this album was very different. But I think it's a beautiful album, everything about it. Is 43 Minutes one of your favorites when you look back at it now?
It was certainly a big turning point.
Yeah.
It was the moment at which I thought, I mean, I'd been on the road promoting Stop for 3 years, and then we did April Moon, and the band with April Moon was very much, it was a really heavy band and very inspired by my brother and my foster brother.
Yeah.
And although I absolutely loved it, it was very much a collaboration. And then when Mum became ill, I think I went right back to my songwriting roots, which is just sitting at the piano on my own. And that was really part of my therapy. And I think actually one reviewer did say that. But it just, obviously, it was a kick up the bum, and it made me think, you know, what do I want to do? Where do I want to go musically? You know, I'd written several blues soul ballads, and that was, you know, the record company, I think, wanted more of that.
Yeah.
But that's never going to happen. It just doesn't work like that, you know. And I'd written them, and they, nothing, obviously, was going to be the same as Stop, because obviously it wouldn't be. So, yeah, 43 Minutes was very much about losing my mum, and it was also a point at which I realised that when you write about your own experience, it really does help other people. And I didn't really have a concept of that before I wrote 43 Minutes. It's been a really good album to me, even though at the time it sold, I think, sold about 4,000 copies, and Stop sold about 2.5 million. But I've never been one for, it doesn't really matter to me. What matters to me is making music.
I think you're absolutely right, because that music like that does help others as they go through their journey of life. You know, because we all lose our moms at some point. And I think that the new album will also help many people. Because of the journey, I think I think the journey is very motivational, and you know, and it is courageous, and it is a story about acceptance, about where you are at the moment, but lyrically, I think it's a wonderful album. I want to go back now to one of my favorite artists, which is John Lord. And I know that the first album you were on was, I imagine your mom instigated this, which was Before I Forget, was 1982, because I think you'd be about 18. Yeah. So was that the first time you met John? Was that your mom who probably knew him from, did you both all live on Henley-on-Thames or somewhere around there?
It was very much like that, yeah. So a lot of sort of rock stars, if you like, moved out to that area. So Alvin Lee lived in that area, Mick Ralphs from Mott the Hoople. John Lord, Ian Pace, David Gilmour was out there at that time. And they did all get together and have a play. So there would be, you know, gatherings of everyone. Yeah. So I knew John. I started working, doing backing vocals when I was 12, 13. I was already singing. And I met John, through my mum. My mum did, I can see Before I Forget behind you. Yeah. Records, and so my mum did a couple of solos, and then he wanted backing vocals, so I went in and did backing vocals with my mum on that album, and we all got very drunk, and John was a very funny man, and mum and John got on great, and we all very much had the same sense of humour.
Wonderful.
Yeah, we created these characters because during the session of doing the backing vocals, we all started talking like that, and we were saying, well, I want Our Beverly wouldn't think that was a very good idea, would she? And then Mum would say, no, but Rita loves it. She absolutely loves it. Beverly won't have it. She's got terrible trouble down below. You know, the three of us were just, it was a very funny session. And I got on great with John. And then after Mum went, I started writing with John, and we wrote Wait a While first.
Because that's from the album Pictured Within, and that album was almost a homage to his own mom and dad, wasn't it? Awesome. And so it was an evening song, and Wait a While, and that was not that long after your own mom passing. Was that kind of a very emotional time, even because your vocal performance on Wait a While, and obviously Evening Song, is just wonderful.
Oh, thank you. It was an interesting thing to do because, you know, John would write these incredibly long classical phrases, and it's not, you know, lyrics are normally kind of, they have boundaries, you know, which is usually a sentence. You have to sing a whole bloody paragraph all in one go, you know, the melody went on and on and on. That's really interesting. I think we had a connection because John adored my mum, and I adored my mum, and John and I got on very well. So, it just kind of was a natural progression in a way. Yeah.
And again, thinking about your lyrics, talking about how observational they are now, one of the songs from John's albums, which was Beyond the Notes, it is One for the Meadow.
Yeah.
And you wrote the lyrics for that and The Sun Will Shine Again. And the lyrics on this, they're almost like a pre-Raphaelite painting.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, they sound like a summer meadow with the sun coming through the leaves on the trees. That's what it sounds. I mean, when you write your lyrics, whether it's that or the new album, do you visualize do you visualize it in like a story in your mind, or do you just see it as words, or how do you create that?
Well, first of all, John had said that he wanted One from the Meadow to be about, you know, he'd go for a walk, and it would be about sharing that walk with someone you really love, you know, and we lived in a similar area. And then I suppose for me, it's about, and Evening Song is the same, it's about painting a picture and inviting somebody into your world. And maybe, you know, giving them a sort of glimpse into a world that they don't know or they haven't seen before. And it's really lovely that you've said that. I mean, I actually, One from the Meadow, I'm quite proud of those lyrics, because I think it does take you on that walk almost, you know.
They are. They're like, they feel like they'd be hung under a painting. You know, on the little brass plaque underneath the painting to say what it was about. They are very visual and really connect to what John was writing in the music. Which you still do with the new album, which is why I think it, I think as a, your lyrics are very, very motivational and visual. And then we go to a, I want to now go where there's no lyrics at all. But it must have taken great courage to do this. It was when you sang The Great Gig in the Sky with Pink Floyd, one of the most famous songs that doesn't have any words at all.
Yes.
I mean, and there you were doing that. How did you approach that? Were you nervous to cover something like that? Or did you just think,
this sounds, it sounds awful really, but you know, it's a job of work. I was hired as a singer, so it is a job of work. I think Claire Torrey, the original, is absolutely incredible piece of work. It really is. And I think Rick, just the core, everything about it, all of them, Rick, Dave and Nick, you know, that it's just, it just creates this atmosphere, which is fantastic, and it builds. So you want the power to build with it. Actually, at that time, I hadn't done any vocal training, and I would have loved to have done it after I'd had vocal training, because it was quite hard, and I didn't really know my voice as well as I should have done. I was nervous, but, you know, there were three of us as well. So I did the first bit, and then Durga did the second bit, and Claudia did the last bit. So we broke it up, which was... quite nice, because you kind of, it's very collaborative, and you're handing it over to the next person, you know, to take it. It was frightening when I first did it, but I loved it. You know, it was great. I really enjoyed doing it. I think so many people have sung that piece, and loads of people have, you know, they've all done it brilliantly. So it just depends on who you like, I suppose.
Yeah. Just pop back to the new album, Number 8, because you use the Melodyne program, which has enabled you to make the music, and it's a different sound, but it still feels like you, to me. Does it feel like it's a new chapter now in your creative endeavours?
Yes, very much so, actually. It really does. And I feel very free to go in whatever direction I want to, which is nice, because, you know, making a sort of an electronic album was, it was deliberate, but it's so not connected to anything like I've ever done before. And I wanted that. I didn't want it to be a poor imitation of my past records, which hinge very much around authentic and organic music and singing, you know. So I knew it was going to have to be different, and Danny just did a fantastic job as well, and he sort of got it. It feels like an ending and a beginning, this album. It feels like I've drawn a line underneath my past career, and I've opened up, a path that can go in any direction that I want it to.
Because in a way, I think I've read this elsewhere. I personally feel it's a very authentic album. Because in a way, you can create the sound of strings through keyboards. A photographer might use Photoshop to put a sunset over a picture. We all use whatever tools are around us. And in a way, you're just using a tool to kind of help you paint the picture that you can see in your mind's eye. So I think it's a very authentic record. I just wonder whether, if you hopefully you'll do another one, would you use this? You'd use obviously the same approach, but would you use more organic instruments like piano or guitars or strings?
I've got so many ideas. I've got loads of ideas. I'd like to do an album with my ukulele clubs, because I'd love to hear them out there. I don't know if it would ever do anything, but I think for them it would be great to sort of tell the story of our ukulele journey together, because that's been amazing. I've met some great people, and I've sort of met people who didn't think they could sing, who turned out to be amazing singers, and, you know, seeing people overcome fear all the time, because it's terrifying getting on stage if you've never done it before, you know. I'd like to do that as a kind of side thing. I've started writing some stuff which is a bit more like my old song, so of the moment, that kind of quite bluesy, dark thing.
Yeah.
And also Danny and I have talked about doing an album, as you say, similar, in fact, exactly what you've just said, similar to Number 8, but using all real musicians. So basically kind of Fatback Band, Kool and the Gang.
Yeah.
That sort of 70s funk. I'd love to do that. I'd really love to do that. I just have to see how it goes. I've sort of got my hands full at the moment.
So is the ukulele club, is that still, that's still a big part of what you do, is it? Because I know that was
That's my job.
That's your main thing.
That's how I make the money for my, you know, my bills. And I'm very grateful to all of those people because they've been amazingly supportive, and I teach about 150 people a week.
Wow. Wow. Did you start that after you lost your voice in about
2010 I started.
2010.
Yeah. And it's been great fun. I have to be careful because I'm not used to a sort of structured existence, and so I have to keep it interesting for myself. Never mind them. I think basically they just like the swearing and the jokes and the, you know, glass of wine with everyone. But we have a lovely time and we play lots of good music, and we played at Alexandra Palace recently. There were 80 of us, and that was just great fun for everyone, you know.
Did you support Judy Zook recently, and was it or Beverly?
Yeah, there was. Yeah. There's a show that my friend promotes, I've known for a long time, a chap called Lee Noble, and he's a really lovely man. And I think he's sort of with the ladies put this together, and it's called Woman to Woman.
Yes, yeah.
Judy Zook, Julia Fordham, Beverly Craven, and Rumour, and they were playing at Alexandra Palace. So yeah.
So wonderful.
He said, do you want to come and play? I said, yeah, but we'll just play in the foyer as people are coming in. Because, you know, otherwise, when you've got a huge amount of people, it's quite a difficult thing to negotiate as far as tickets and how many people can come in and all that. So to keep it quite sort of free and open.
And as you said, for a lot of those people, it would be quite nerve-wracking to suddenly find themselves plopped on the front of a big stage as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, although we did play at Cornbury some years ago. And yeah. That was good, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Sam. And just want to show the album, Number 8. Where's the best place people can get hold of a copy?
You can get it everywhere. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it HMV. Everywhere. You can get it online. It's on Spotify. It's on iTunes. If you want a signed copy, you can go through my website. You'll get it cheaper elsewhere. But I will sign it for you if you just put a little note on your order. There's a place where you can put it on your order. And my website is misssambrown.com.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Sam. And make sure everybody, I'll put the web address at the bottom of the description on the video and on the website where this podcast will appear as well. But I just want to thank you so much for all of your time and wish you lots of luck for the future. And it's great to talk to you. And I really hope this is a new chapter in your creative endeavours.
Well, it's been lovely to talk to you, Phil. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening so thoroughly. I really appreciate it.
No, absolutely. You're very, very welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in, and a big thank you to my guest, Sam Brown. And please check out the website, nowspinning.co.uk, and subscribe to make sure you don't miss out on any future episode. Thank you very much. Stay safe, and I'll see you again soon.